Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. To kill or not to kill? That is the question still presented to juries in capital cases in the United States, one of the few remaining countries in the world to employ the death penalty. In this edition of Radio Curious, we visit with Pastor Carol Pickett, who served as a chaplain for the Texas Department of Correction from 1982 to 1995 and counseled 95 inmates on their way to execution by lethal injection. At the Death House Door, No Man Should Die Alone, is an independent film documentary directed and produced by Steve James and Peter Gilbert that presents a personal and intimate look at the death penalty in Texas through the eyes of Pastor Carol Pickett, a Presbyterian minister. Over the years, after each of the 95 executions, Pickett would record his experiences with that person on the tape recorder he used to practice his sermons. Although he never listened to those tapes, they became the thread and primary source for the movie At the Death House Door. I spoke with Pastor Carol Pickett on May 23, 2008, from his home in Texas, after I heard him speak at a special hearing on capital punishment in San Francisco, which was part of his national publicity tour for the movie. When we began, I asked him to explain what brought him to work with the condemned people in Texas and be with them in their last hours.
Warden Persley called us all together in the latter part of November. We hadn't, any of us, thought about execution. We knew the execution chamber was there on the uni, but nobody went there.
That was during the time of the Supreme Court moratorium on death penalty.
That's right. There hadn't been an execution there since 1964. 1982, there was really nobody working at the prison who had been there back during the old electric chair days. So we were, it was all new, and he called us together and told us there was going to be an execution. And that was the beginning of the many long trips down the hall to the death house. It wasn't a part of my job description. It wasn't anywhere in there. But nobody thought about that.
Your assignment to be with the condemned men, tell us about that.
When the warden called us in, and he just went around, and he went around and told us we were going to have an execution. And of course, there had never been a lethal injection anywhere in the world. So nobody knew what it was going to be like. And there was no protocol, there was nobody to talk to, no book had been written. So he just went around and assigned everybody a responsibility. And I was seated next to the door, next to the major, and he got to the major and he said, "You're in charge of security." When he came to me, he said, "Your job is to seduce his emotions so he won't fight coming out of the cell and he won't fight getting up on the gurney." Which was many people's most unwanted activity to happen.
Can you tell us what your thoughts were, what your reactions were as a clergyman when you were told to seduce a person's emotions so they wouldn't fight and voluntarily go to death?
Well, we can call it transference, but I've been with so many people who had died that I just tried to keep them calm, you know, even though they were dying of some other disease. You know, cancer is not a pleasant one. I was with my father when he died just months before that. You know, I just tried to keep those people as calm as they can, and to not be afraid of dying if it, you know, it's going to come, particularly. And I tried to think, you know, to make it sound like I was ministering to them just like I would if they were dying of some other disease, or some disease rather than there's no disease. This was
a planned effort on the part of the state of Texas.
Right. Practically every one of them were healthy, strong, and basically young people. And that made it a whole lot different than somebody who's struggling with cancer for 4 or 5 years.
That was different from a physical plane on the part of the inmate. How was it for you and for the other people who were involved in the procedure, let's call it?
It was extremely hard, particularly the first one, because the first one was just a young man and he was in great health and he was in a good attitude. I had two guards with me in the death house all day long. It was difficult to just think that here's a healthy person who's worked out with on equipment and is in good shape, and at midnight they were going to take him in and basically kill him when he had nothing wrong with him physically. And that was the hardest part, to see a person in really good shape physically and know that he was going to be killed just after midnight.
What kinds of conversations or desires did the condemned man bring up when they were talking with you?
They thought the first thing they had to do was talk about their religious faith. If they had any, they would just tell me up right up front. You know, the warden would tell them, he would meet with them after they were put in the cell. He said, here's my chaplain, he represents me, and I won't see you again until after midnight, and if you need anything, you talk to him, and I recommend that you talk. He's a good counselor and a good listener, and if you need anything, you got to go to me, go through me up to him. So they would, you know, right off the bat, they would say, you know, well, I'm Muslim, I'm Catholic, I'm this, I'm that, whatever it was. And but then they would just want to start talking about different things. First one in, the very first thing he wanted to do in the morning was play chess. He wanted to play chess right away. After we explained to him that what was going to take place during the day, he said, well, can I play chess? And I found a guard who could play chess. And he came down and played chess for several hours with the person. And there were many other requests, which some people call small, but they were important to them that last day.
In this edition of Radio Curious, we're talking with Reverend Carol Pickett, whose story is a thread in the movie At the Death House Door, No Man Should Die Alone. Reverend Carol Pickett was with almost 100 men hours before they were executed in the death house by the state of Texas. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Reverend Pickett, at the beginning of your work with these men, you were a proponent or in favor of the death penalty. At some point, your feelings changed, and now, if I'm correct, you're opposed to the death penalty.
That's correct. The only thing, it wasn't a point. It was a growth. It was a growing period. It was an evaluation period. It was watching things take place that I felt were not only wrong, but immoral, and as the longer I stayed there, the more and more I began to see that my feeling, which I had learned from my father, because his father had been murdered and nothing had been done, that I had not been misled, because he did the best he could do. But I began to see different things taking place that caused me to. It was a growth period of learning about the whole procedure, not just the medical procedure of lethal injection, but the legal system. And we were executing people I knew were innocent. It became rather difficult.
What were some of those elements that you refer to?
In Texas, there's this law or rule, they call it, where two people commit a crime, and one of them will snitch first and point the finger at the other one. One who snitches first gets an 8 or 10 year sentence, and then the other one gets executed. And it's called the law of parties. and they're considered to be a part of the crime. And we, Texas, was executing people that did not kill. I mean, right from the very beginning, we had a man who was yards and yards and yards away from where the crime took place, but he was there. And the other fellow blamed him, and the state knew he didn't do the killing, but he was executed. I thought that was not only should be considered illegal, but it was also immoral to allow one person to finger the other person, and he gets off, and then the one that doesn't pull the trigger gets executed. I began to see more and more of those type of situations. As I watched, there were more blacks and browns, and then I saw one city, everybody knows it's Houston. They were just sending people right and left, and they would appoint bad attorneys. That became another problem. I saw attorneys that really didn't try to help an inmate. And one attorney, after I was with his 16th failure, you know, I began to see, what is this system doing in that particular county? And then I saw the pain that started coming, and the pain that was in all families. And then there was the suffering also of my staff. Now that, when they began to suffer, we all suffer. Well, nobody could go through an execution without feeling something, unless they were really cold.
When you say your staff, did you include the warden?
Wardens did too.
Because you mention in the movie that after an execution, the warden was always gone the next day, stayed home sick.
Right. He'd call, you know, there was one warden that would call me that mid-afternoon. He'd say, you know, I need you to get me a doctor. And, of course, I'd bet him, he was new. He wasn't the original warden that we had, because when our first warden retired quickly, and then they brought up another from down south, and he didn't know the population of Huntsville. And he called me and said, can you get me a doctor? It bothered them, too. Warden turnover at the Walls unit is tremendous. I know of at least six wardens that retired too early because they just could not do executions.
How come you were able to stay during this time?
I think it was a commitment to be with somebody. I did not that I was the greatest in the world, but I never had a man fight. I never had a man fight coming out of the cell or get up on the gurney.
They would get up on the gurney themselves?
Yes, except the one that had the stroke, and there was one short, large man that the guards had to help put up there. But most of them would just back around and just vault up on it. I mean, because I would explain to them all day long, it's not going to do any good to fight it. Once you get in there, you're not going to like it. You're not going to like what you see. But I'd explain it to them, draw them pictures, whatever it would take to let them know what's going to be behind that door. Because they were only 8 steps away from the door all day long. And I just felt like that I should stay there because this is what God wanted me to do, and for lack of a better term, we and the guards and I had been pretty successful in doing what the wardens wanted.
After each execution, you went back to your home and told a story into a tape recorder about the inmate who had just died. Can you tell us about what moved you to do that and about your collection of stories?
I have a degree in clinical pastoral education, which means I counsel people. And of course, I major in psychology. But back during the Carrasco affair, we called a psychologist, a psychiatrist, to come up and help watch the people. And this doctor Garcia had told me, he said, you've got to realize that everybody is like a glass or a jar, and we keep things that affect us are like bubbles, drops, and the drops keep going in there. Once you get to a drop, And the last drop, it's going to overflow. Now, which drop do you blame it on? And he said, everybody needs to talk to somebody. And he had told me that in 1974. When I got home from the first one with Charlie Brooks, you know, I couldn't sleep. It was 4 o'clock in the morning. I just left his son's. I was sitting on the couch, and I looked over where on my bookcase, and there was a tape recorder. The tape recorder that I had used to record sermons for practice, I'll talk to that. There was nobody there. And I didn't think there was anybody who could understand. If I could, you know, call anybody or wait till the next day or wait till the next week. So I just sat down on the floor and just started talking. And I talked an hour and a half, and then it was time to go back to work. And so I just kept on doing this. I'd get through with it and seal them, put them in a box and hide them.
How many of those tapes do you have now?
All of those are gone. They're somewhere with the people that did the film. I never listened to them. I had no purpose. You know, there was no ulterior motive like, I'm going to write a book, or I'm going to do a show, or I'm going to say this sometime. My kids didn't know about it, and my family and I were very close. Nobody knew about them. They were all just sealed and put in a closet. I had no reason to open them up, and I never listened to any of them.
During the time that you were working with the inmates and preparing them for death, who did you feel you were serving?
It was a combination. One of the things, you know, like the warden had said, you're responsible to me. And then I wrote a document, which is used by most of the states, on the team concept of lethal injection, because we were the first to do it. The ministerial part of me, which I had forever, was there. And then my main feeling was nobody should die alone. I don't want to die alone. You know, I don't want to be by myself. And so being with them and being able to listen to them, in the beginning I could bring in visitors, their family, and I was ministering to the families too. So I knew there was a combination there of ministry, and these were all God's children. Whether they believed in anything or not, I just felt like that my ministry was to be with them and to do anything, big or small, little or important, that might be important to them that last day. So I felt like I was serving both, if you want to call it both, but mainly I was there to help this man face the last 18 hours. In those last few minutes.
In the film At the Death House Door, No Man Should Die Alone, you mention that every major denomination in the United States has a position paper against the death penalty. So I'm curious as to why you think the death penalty is supported to the extent that it is.
I really don't know. My denomination has a very strong position against it.
That's Presbyterian.
That's right. And in 1977, they reaffirmed it and strengthened it. And I attended the meeting, and I spoke very strongly in favor of the death penalty because just 2 years before, I had buried two of my members. Having been a minister now for 53 years, I've seen that the position papers taken by denominations sometimes just go by the wayside. The Methodist Church, the United Methodist Church, just 3 weeks ago, took a very strong, strong position against, asked all of its members, to support the elimination of the death penalty. And we have president who goes to the Methodist Church, and he never stopped any execution here in Texas. We have a lady running for president who is also goes to the Methodist Church. So they just don't listen. I don't understand that. I do not know why, with all the position papers, that people do not understand that executions are basically immoral. Now, I would just think people who are so strongly in favor of execution, if they could just go watch one. You know, I've said this before, that the Supreme Court. There's nine of them, and all of those nine would go to watch an execution in nine different places. And if one of the executions had been botched, as that's a term somebody else invented, I didn't, they would, I think they would find it. If you watch it from the time you walk them out of the door, get them on the gurney, strap them down, and then spend a long time trying to find a vein that works, you'll find out that it is not painless.
Do you think there should be another way for the state to kill people other than lethal injections?
No, I think they ought to just quit killing them. I don't see that. I think America is a bigger country than this. We don't need, you know, there's not but five countries in the world that are executing people. Most of those are our enemies, and we're on the same plane they are. It's not deterring crime. When I started, there was 51 on death row. We've executed over 400. Now we got 500 on death row. It doesn't deter crime. It's very, very expensive. And now we've done a lot of innocent people. And that's the thing that bothers me the most. I will never get over Carl Staluna. Never.
Tell us about him.
Carlos was a young boy. He was the same age as my son was at the time, and he was innocent. I knew he was innocent from the time he came in. Everything that he told me pointed that way. I didn't go back and do history work on these people, but it's been proven by Chicago Tribune that there was no way in the world that committed this crime, and the man that committed the crime had the same first name, but he was in prison. There's prison pipeline that if you're on one unit, you can say anything, and it'll get back to the whole unit. And he was bragging all the time. Carlos Hernandez kept bragging that he did it. And then the worst thing is the prosecutor said that there was no Carlos Hernandez. That was just a phantom. And that prosecutor had represented him and had examined him and talked to him. And he knew there was a Carlos Hernandez. Everybody in Corpus Christi knew Carlos Hernandez was a mean man who did everything with that same knife, the knife that was found at the scene of the crime.
That Carlos Staluna was accused of using.
There are no fingerprints. There was no blood on Carlos Staluna. There was no motive there. There was no money taken, nothing that would show that he had anything at all to do with that. But they just saw him. They arrested him, and he was arrested and convicted in 40 minutes. That's just not right. And he didn't get a decent lawyer. And we became real close friends all during that day. And the hard part was he had no father that he knew, and when he started asked permission and started calling me daddy, and he called me daddy on the gurney, and then that did it. And the execution didn't go properly, and he was innocent.
In some way, listening to you now and when I heard you speak on May 11th, 2008, it sounds like you're carrying a burden that you want to share with the world and change this. Am I hearing the right thing?
Yes, sir. You're hearing it very loud and clear. I have been, like I told you at the beginning, I've been in the last 13 days. I've been all over the United States from coast to coast. We go anywhere we can, and we've got too many and we can't make them all. But I will continue to share this, that America is a better country than this. We don't need to kill our own people. It doesn't do anything. It's very expensive, and they've already released 100, and I think it's 30, who've been proven to be innocent. And they've been released, and there's more to it, more coming.
When you were told as a young person coming out of seminary that you would spend your ministry with death and dying, did you have any imagination that it would be as it turned out?
Absolutely not, sir. I never even thought about executions.
In retrospect, what do you think?
I think what I felt like that he was he was saying was that I want you to be a minister who takes care of people. And I know when I went to my first church, there was one man who voted against me coming to that. And he was a doctor, and he owned a hospital. And he said, the reason I voted against you coming here is because I wanted a minister who would visit and take care of the death and the dying in my hospital, and I didn't think you were old enough. And I struggled real hard to prove that I could be a minister to the death and dying in that little hospital in that little town in South Texas. And he and I became real good friends, and eventually I ended up conducting his funeral. And he said he made a mistake, and that I was qualified to take care of his patients.
Well, Reverend Carol Pickett, I want to thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious. And before we close, can you tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately?
Just Call Me Mike. It's the story of Mike Farrell, who was BJ in the series MASH, and he's in California, and he is a very active person in the anti-death penalty movement. And when I read that book, about the first three chapters, they were a mirror of my life. Very good book, and he is a great man. I met him, I've talked to him, we're going to meet again, and he's a really super man.
Well, Reverend Carol Pickett, thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
Thank you very much for talking.
Pastor Carol Pickett served as the chaplain for the Texas Department of Corrections from 1982 to 1995 and counseled 95 inmates on their way to execution by lethal injection. The book he recommends is Just Call Me Mike, A Journey to Actor and Activist by Mike Farrell and Martin Sheehan. This program was recorded May 23rd, 2008. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. There are over 750 archives on our website, radiocurious.org, and I'm honored to tell you that Radio Curious is now part of the collection at the Library of Congress. We appreciate your cards, ideas, and letters, and do enjoy hearing from you. The email is curious@radiocurious.org. The postal address is 700 West Smith Street, Ukiah, California, 95482. The phone is 707-621-5075. Ignacio Ayala is the assistant producer. I'm host and producer Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.